This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. I expect that there are a lot of people who are familiar with the Hollywood blacklist. This was something that occurred during the Cold War, at a time when in the United States there was a great deal of fear of communism. And this was a list which included people in Hollywood, screenwriters, actors, directors, people who were denied employment because of their political beliefs or because of what someone said were their political beliefs. We were talking this morning about something that is, I expect, less well-known, but a parallel kind of blacklist that occurred at the same time and that involved people who worked in radio and television. And our guest for the program is David Everett. He is the author of a recently published book that we will talk about. The title of his book is A Shadow of Red, Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television, published by Arvin R.D., which is a publisher out of Chicago. And it tells the story of this effort in radio and television that happened probably with the key event about 1950 with the publication of a booklet called Red Channels, which purported to list suspected communist sympathizers in broadcasting. Very quickly after that, a blacklist in radio and television got going. And we'll be talking about it this morning in this part of the show. David Everett is a former magazine editor. He has written on entertainment and the media for different publications, including the New York Times, Entertainment Weekly, Biography, American History, other publications. His other books include one titled King of the Half Hour, which is about a television writer who was very important in the what many people call the golden age of television comedy, a man named Nat Hiken. That's that book. And then the brand new one, as I mentioned, is just out now, A Shadow of Red. Questions are welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455, by the way. So whichever of those numbers works for you, if you'd like to call in, you can do that. Again, we just ask people to be brief so that we can keep things moving along. But anyone is welcome to call. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Everett, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I think it's interesting just to start out, as you do, to talk in a general way about not only why the blacklist in broadcasting was important, and it's something that people should at least know a little bit about, but about why it is that this was you shouldn't just sort of fold this into the Hollywood blacklist story, that this is a story that stands on its own for a number of reasons that you point out, starting out with the fact that certainly Hollywood was very influential, but here we're talking about a much, much bigger audience when you talk about all of the people listening to radios and watching television in the United States at this time.
Oh, certainly, yeah. It did reach a much wider audience. And also the nature of the medium makes it different, and I think really a more compelling story, especially when talking about vigilance versus civil liberties, because, well, in Hollywood, that's basically an entertainment factory. And radio and TV, obviously, they were involved in entertainment as well, but there was a great deal of news and commentary and documentaries on there. And there's an area where you can at least make the case that you should be concerned about how things are being slanted. And this was a concern for people on both the right and the left, as a matter of fact, during those days, and really still is till today. And it's also a very, very much a separate story, because what you have in the Hollywood blacklist, you really had a purge that was imposed from above, essentially by the House Un-American Activities Committee. In the broadcast field, it really was a phenomenon, for the most part, that was generated from below, a sort of grassroots movement that involved private groups, and essentially it really boils down to five people who were able to get the blacklist going and were able to get the broadcasters to go along with it. And those five people are three former FBI agents who published an anti-communist newsletter called Counterattack, you get the idea of what sort of militant stance they were taking from the title itself. And also, even more important, a booklet called Red Channels, which listed 151 suspected communist sympathizers in the broadcast field. And what made that especially potent is that it came out in the summer of 1950, and just 3 days after it came out, news reached the United States that North Korea had invaded South Korea. So the timing was really crucial because it came out just as the Cold War suddenly got very hot. And within just a few months, the blacklist began to take hold, and it was based to a great extent on this booklet that they put out called Red Channels.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also another man who was involved with it by the name of Vincent Hartnett, who went on to be what was called a talent consultant, which meant that he put together dossiers on entertainers and commentators and whatever in the broadcast field, and broadcasters would base their decisions on whether these people should work or not, to a great extent, on these dossiers. And then the fifth member of this group was, incredibly enough, a grocer from Syracuse, New York, who managed, and this is probably the most interesting part of the story, managed to get media moguls to dance to his tune with an influence which was, well, let's say very debatable at best.
Mm-hmm. The men that you described, the three FBI agents, John Keenan, Kenneth Bierley, and Theodore Kirkpatrick, they were all very concerned about the potential spread of communism in the United States. And certainly that at the time was, there were a lot of people who were concerned about communism in the United States. But these men, it seemed, particularly were interested in media and the possibility that media could be used either by people that they would consider to be subversives to get out their message. I think they were also interested in the fact that media could be used to get out their message, that is, their message about communism and its prevalence in the United States. What do you think, that there was something in particular that got them interested in using media and also to focus on media and people who they considered to be communist or communist sympathizers who were working in media? I mean, why media? Why was media such a big interest for them?
Well, first, it had to do with the training they had in the FBI. None of these three men were particularly political or ideological before they joined the FBI, but then they all became part of this so-called communist squad in New York City, which was involved, well, they were not involved in investigating Soviet espionage, but they were involved in investigating communist infiltration of organizations, such as unions, for instance. And it was while they were doing this that they really became fervent partisans, and they became very frustrated about the fact that it seemed that people in the public were not sufficiently alarmed about what communists might be doing. And that's why they left the FBI, so they could publicize the information that they felt was very important. One of the things that they investigated while they were in the FBI was the infiltration of communications industry. But even then, when they started counterattack, it wasn't their number one concern. They were really concerned with a pretty broad spectrum of businesses and industries and unions. But it seemed to gather momentum in 48 and 49, and then it was Red Channels, which I think really the impact it had caught them by surprise. They were always concerned about it, but this really seemed to capture people's imagination and concerns. And the way they looked at it as far as the media was concerned, first, they were concerned about radio commentators. As I said before, that's something that, you know, people tend to be concerned about, what sort of slant they might be giving to the news or what's going on in the world. But then it eventually sort of gravitated and migrated towards entertainment in general. And that's a case where it's more difficult to make a case that infiltration is going to be a real factor. But what they developed along the way was something that could be called the third violinist theory. They were once asked by an interviewer, why is it so important, for instance, that the third violinist in a radio studio orchestra is a communist sympathizer? The answer they came up with is, well, the third violinist sits next to the first violinist, and he may know someone in the control booth. He may know an announcer as well. So the way they looked at it is that anyone, any communist sympathizer in any position in broadcasting could be a potential security risk. Hmm. And really, once they started to look at things in that way, then they just, it really opened up a Pandora's box, because then anyone could come under suspicion whether they could really have much of an impact or not.
One of the things that I'm curious about is the way that they, and as this thing got going, people thought about content and whether that was, in what way that was problematic, and whether we're talking about people who are concerned that left-wing political operatives are going to get hold of the airwaves and going to send out a message that says, let's take over the United States, or whether, and I'm being just a tiny bit flip, or whether the concern really was that views that would, might, other people might consider to be progressive left-wing views, things like anti-fascism and concern about nuclear proliferation and civil rights and anti-Semitism, what have you, were considered to be beyond the pale, and so that it wasn't just that, you know, wasn't just the people on there talking about the Soviet Union being great or America being bad, but that we're encouraging real kind of discussion or airing of left-wing opinion, and that's really what people were picking up on.
Well, there, I'm sure there were people who were just concerned about anything remotely to do with the New Deal, for instance, and the, all the political ideas that went with that. But the people that we're talking about here, I really don't think that was their main concern. Well, one of the concerns is that in an emergency, for instance, communists could take over a control booth and create a panic. And the, well, the instance that they cite was the famous War of the Worlds broadcast by Orson Welles, which did demonstrate that radio could produce a panic. Also, they were concerned that people on the air, especially radio commentators, could, you know, start to slant the news or the commentary in such a way that would be useful to the Soviet Union. It should be pointed out that recent documents have established that there were journalists who were Soviet agents or were, at the very least, pretty faithful party liners. One of them was a man by the name of Johannes Steele, who's mentioned in the Venona decryptions. But I'd have to say by 1950, they were pretty much marginalized. But as when you're talking about the concern about progressive ideas, I think that leads to something else which is really very central to this whole thing, is how to handle the phenomenon of the Communist Front organizations. And this was just a very tricky issue, and it created a lot of problems and a lot of mischief. And what we're doing is talking about organizations that had very benign-sounding names, like the Hollywood Anti-Fascist League or the National Council for American-Soviet Friendship. And they were involved in very legitimate liberal causes. But at the same time, there were, there was a communist influence in a lot of these organizations, and was part of the communist strategy at the time. And what could happen very often is that the these groups, which started out promoting, as I say, legitimate liberal ideas, when push came to shove and the interests of the Soviet Union came into play, they would suddenly switch. And the classic example is when communist front groups would say one day at the end of, in sometime in 1939, that we have to emphasize collective security and support all allies against fascist powers. And then as soon as the Soviet Union signed a non-aggression pact, they would then say, well, we can't get into the war at all, and we shouldn't be involved in aiding Britain against Nazi Germany. That sort of thing happened quite a bit, and a lot of the more perceptive people in these organizations would then leave these organizations because they could see there was something else involved here. But was, I think, what had a, you know, a greater impact on this whole blacklist phenomenon is that whether they planned this or not, the communists who were involved in influencing these seemingly liberal organizations, what they managed to do was to blur the line between communists and liberals. And I think ultimately this put a lot of liberals in peril to a certain extent once the blacklist went into effect.
Let me introduce again our guest with this part of Focus 580, David Everett. We're talking about some of the history that you can read about in his book, A Shadow of Red. The subtitle is Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television, published by Ivan D., publisher based in Chicago. And it takes a look at the blacklist in broadcasting and radio and television, something that was kind of a parallel effort to the blacklist in Hollywood, although probably not as well known as the one that existed in Hollywood. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As you explained, the thing that really kicked this off was the publication of this booklet, this pamphlet, Red Channels, in 1950, listing people purported to be communist or communist sympathizers. And you take a look at some of the people on the list. Some of the people were at the time quite famous and still are. They're people whose names that you would still recognize, other people not. And it seems that, in fact, some of these people, their careers were destroyed and they were destroyed. Some people, it seems to be that they were affected not at all, or at least very little. Maybe you could talk just a little bit about for those people who suffered the most as a consequence of having their name on this list, what was their experience?
Well, probably the best example would be Philip Loeb, who was, at the time that Red Channels came out, he was a co-star on the popular radio series The Goldbergs. And right away, he ran into trouble. The producer of the show, Gertrude Berg, tried to keep him on the show, but she couldn't keep the sponsors as long as he was on the show, so she had to fire him. And after that, he was really totally blacklisted from radio and TV. And this actually is not something that happened all the time. Most people, I think when people talk about people who are blacklisted, to a great extent, you're talking about people who are what's called graylisted. They could work for some people, but not others. In the case of Philip Loeb, he could not get any work at all in radio and TV. He could still work in the theater, but he wasn't the same kind of money that he was making. And also, he had other problems, including a son who was suffering from schizophrenia and in an expensive private institution that he could no longer afford. And eventually, where all this led was to Philip Loeb's suicide in 1955. So here you have a case of a true casualty of the blacklist. Hmm. But there, as I say, in other ways, the blacklist could be porous, and sometimes producers and executives would stand up to the blacklisters, and they were able to do it and get away with it.
It's interesting to me that apparently the blacklist didn't extend to theater, and that people in the New York theater world virtually didn't pay any attention to it at all. So people who were blacklisted for television, for example, or were graylisted, they seemingly didn't have the same kind of problem if they wanted to go and perform on the stage.
Certainly that was the case. I think perhaps what one factor there is that the theater did not rely on advertising. on advertising. And that was the real Achilles heel for broadcasting, because if the sponsors got skittish, then immediately the broadcasters got skittish and they would make a move. In the theater, you don't have that. But then again, in the movie industry, that's another medium that doesn't rely on advertising, or at least back then it didn't. It does now, you know, when you go to the movie theaters. But back then they weren't relying on advertising, and still they caved in. So ultimately it comes down to the issue of giving in to these people, or as opposed to showing some courage. And I think that's really an important issue about this phenomenon, is that when it comes to people who are publishing information about people in the entertainment field that they believe to be communists or communist sympathizers, they do have a First Amendment right to do that, provided that they don't libel people. But what really gave them the power to institute a blacklist was the fact that the networks and the sponsors were quick to go to give in to them, some quicker than others. Some didn't really give in at all. The first and foremost in that case would be CBS, which was considered the most liberal network up until 1950. And they caved in very quickly and instituted a loyalty oath and a political screening process, and quickly became the toughest network as far as enforcing the blacklist. But then there were others that showed that you didn't have to do that. At ABC, at around the same time, Gypsy Rose Lee, the stripper turned author turned actress, was about to go on with on the radio with a quiz show, and there was an immediate protest from the American Legion charging that she was involved in various Communist Front activities. And Robert Kintner, who was head of ABC at the time, then came back with what seems to be, I think, a very sensible response. He told the American Legion, well, if you have proof behind these allegations, please send them to me and I'll take a look at them. And the response of the American Legion was, well, we don't have the proof, but you have to talk to the Red Channels people. And then the Red Channels people said, well, this is all the information we have. It's just based on public documents, and it's really up to the public to decide. So each person was passing the buck. And what eventually happened is that, well, nothing happened to Gypsy Rose Lee. She was able to get on this show. And actually, Robert Kintner then won a Peabody Award for his courage in this particular case. And there are other instances of that as well. Mark Goodson, for instance, the great quiz show producer, was able to stand up to blacklisters on a number of occasions. And as he put it, he learned that this is something that you could do. But there were many others who gave in very quickly. And so I think you really have to look at the responsibility to a great extent of the broadcasters and the sponsors in letting all of this happen.
Mm. I'm interested in having you talking a little bit more about the sponsor angle. And perhaps here we might again talk about Lawrence Johnson, this man who, as you say, said at the beginning, there are really five people who perhaps more than any other individuals were responsible for the blacklist for broadcasting. And as you said, one of the big differences between this and the Hollywood blacklist is that this was really a grassroots effort. It came up from the bottom, and it was a very small, really, the people who were instrumental in making this work, in making this go, there was a very small number of people. Among them, the three men who were the former FBI agents who were responsible for Red Channels, and then this man, Lawrence Johnson, who was had a chain of supermarkets in the Northeast. Tell us more about Lawrence Johnson.
Yes, well, he owned six supermarkets in the Syracuse, New York area. And at the time that he became involved in all this in 1951, he was 62 years old. He was, you know, you would think he would be more concerned with other things like looking forward to retirement or something like that. But he was really energized by what was going on in the Korean War, which is an important factor because all this has to be seen in the context as a wartime emergency measure that was taken. And his son-in-law, who had served in World War II in the Marines, was called back to duty and was sent into combat in Korea. And his son-in-law's wife, Lawrence Johnson's daughter, was actually the first one to become very involved in this. She was incensed that while her husband was fighting in Korea, there were these supposed communist sympathizers on the air in shows that she was hearing in her own living room, and sponsors were selling products that she herself was buying. And so she made a lot of speeches to American Legion conventions and also to Kiwanis clubs and that sort of thing. And it was through her that Lawrence Johnson became involved. He had been involved in patriotic activities before, but it was never anything like this, not anything as fervent as this, that's for sure. And what he did was to supply the economic angle, the economic leverage to the whole blacklist phenomenon. What he would tell the sponsors in particular, that's who we really focused on, is that if they continue to have communist sympathizers on their shows, he's going to make it difficult for these sponsors to sell their products in his stores. He would threaten them by saying that if they didn't comply with his wishes, he would put up a sign above the sponsor's products saying that this manufacturer employs, as he would put it, Stalin's little creatures, meaning the communist sympathizers on the show. And he claimed to have a great deal of influence. But as I think I mentioned before, this is very debatable, and I don't think he really did have any considerable influence in this area. As I said, he had the six supermarkets. Obviously, he could determine what happened in those stores, but he claimed to have an influence in the entire central New York region. And he also claimed to have influence nationally because he was involved in a supermarket retailers association. And he claimed that he could influence what they did as well. But there's really very little evidence that he did have this kind of influence. And what is, I think, the real point here is that his supposed clout was never really tested by sponsors or by the networks. They gave in too quickly to do that. And so it was never put to the test, except in one case, by broadcasters who knew Lawrence Johnson much better than these national media corporations did. The broadcasters in Syracuse also came under fire from Lawrence Johnson. He, in particular, was one radio station that was playing the records of Artie Shaw, who was listed in red channels, and also they were playing records by the Weavers, which was something that always incensed the Red Hunters. And what they decided to do, the broadcasters in Syracuse, is they decided to have a meeting on the campus of Syracuse University to decide what to do about Lawrence Johnson and about the pressure tactics that he was using. Essentially, what they decided was to tell him to take a hike, that they weren't going to listen to what he was going to say and they weren't going to do what he said. And the upshot of the whole thing is that he was powerless to do anything about it. And what's interesting is he had actually some real influence with these broadcasters because he would buy airtime for advertisements for his stores on these radio stations. So there was some actual economic leverage there, but still they were able to stand up to him. And the one of the broadcasters in Syracuse actually at the time was just really baffled at why the national sponsors and the national networks and broadcasters would give in to Lawrence Johnson so easily. As he put it, I guess those guys down in New York are so big that they're stupid. And it's very interesting that they were not, these big companies didn't even think of standing up to him.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here, and I just quickly want to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with David Everett. He's a former magazine editor, writes on entertainment and the media for a number of publications. His work has appeared in New York Times, Entertainment Weekly, Biography, American History, other publications. He is the author of a recently published book that looks at communism and the blacklist in radio and television. The title of his book is A Shadow of Red, and it's published by Ivan R.D. out of Chicago. Questions are welcome here on the Focus 580. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here to bring in the conversation in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I had a course which used Eric Bornow's Tube of Plenty, which was a condensation of his, eight-volume book, and he had sections of this. I'm interested that the full-length book would probably be more comprehensive, but know enough to be dangerous here. I wonder if you included Studs Terkel's anecdote about his being he was threatened with not being allowed to go on unless he signed some kind of loyalty oath. He had his name on a lot of petitions that were circulated by a whole manner of left-leaning groups. And I think, if I recall right, Mahalia Jackson actually wielded enough power to say, I want this guy. And do you know about that story? Or?
I've heard about that. You know, and I'm aware of the accusations that were made about him and the suspicions that were raised about him. I did not happen to include it in my book. But, of course, that's fairly typical. And it's always, it can be difficult to figure out, for one thing, whether these accusations were accurate or not, but they're, I think, a lot of cases, and this doesn't have to do with Studs Terkel in particular, but a lot of cases, I think people who were blacklisted probably were either communists or fellow travelers, but there were notable cases where that was clearly not the case. One would be a man by the name of Joe Julian, who was an actor, who had two citations in Red Channels, and both of them were really pretty innocuous because they were sort of activities that a liberal would get involved with just as much as a communist would at that time. Even more to the point, he starred in a radio expose about communism called Communism U.S. Brand, which is something that no communist would have been involved with. And still, he was, well, he was graylisted in a pretty injurious way. And that would be an example of someone who clearly the accusations were not correct.
Well, I'm a little disappointed you're not more forthright about defending Studd's ability to do what he wanted to do. The context of the Times was such that, you know, we had Coughlin on going after the godless communists. Indeed, there were left-wingers fleeing Germany. Bertolt Brecht was writing screenplays in L.A. At the time, or part of this time. At the same time, there was a big right-wing capacity of Hollywood, too. They basically used newsreels to go after Upton Sinclair, if I'm recalling, when he ran for governor of California and baited him. So it was a complex milieu. I mean, you could focus on red channels. The right channels were quite full at the time. You haven't mentioned Lucy either. I gather that's always a real
Lucille Ball.
Yeah, of course, because it's important. But you know, again, the context of the time was that Hoover had a blue pen. He could edit. They would send G-Man Hoover on the radio scripts, and then after that, the FBI series. I bring this up rather regularly because Hoover, you know, maybe had something on some producer out there from one of the parties he was at or something. You know, he could edit the scripts to make sure the FBI looked good and all that. So there's a lot there. I'll listen.
Sure. And I wasn't, I suppose I gave the wrong impression. I wasn't trying to intimate that there was a good reason to keep Studs Terkel off the air. There was not a good reason. If you read my book, you'll see that's clearly my point of view. But you bring up the Lucille Ball case, which is interesting because once again this shows the complicity of networks and sponsors in this whole process, because she came under suspicion early on in her show's run. And apparently she had signed, I think she registered to vote for the Communist Party back in the 1930s. And this was the sort of thing that could get some lesser star off the air rather quickly. But in this case, the CBS was willing to stand by her, and they just continued her show. And there is absolutely no consequences that they faced as a result of it. So it really showed what could be done if they were willing to stand up to the pressure.
And I suppose, that also tells you something about her personal popularity.
Oh, sure.
As a performer. I think I recall the story is that she was defended tearfully by her husband, who said something like, the only thing red about her is her hair, and even that's not real.
Right. Well, yeah, her popularity was what it was all about. She was the franchise for CBS. So yeah. They were perfectly willing to, you know, jettison people who they didn't think were important, most of whom turned out to be writers because they never seemed to be considered to be very important. But once it was a very important star and something, a real moneymaker for the organization, then they were willing to stand up.
How did the performers' professional unions, particularly, I guess I'm thinking here about AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and that's the union that's the actors and the news people and singers and all kinds of people who work as performers in commercial broadcasting. How did they respond to this challenge?
Initially, there were some protests. There were some resolutions passed to investigate the whole blacklisting phenomenon once it first got started. But those pretty quickly faded away, and AFTRA became a very really a right-wing union. There was a group called the Actors Committee, which pretty much controlled the board in that union. And they were, actually played a role, apparently, in the blacklist. There were people there who were conferring with Lawrence Johnson and other people. And this became ultimately the battleground. By 1955, there were people in AFTRA who wanted to change things. And there was an election that year, and finally a new slate of candidates were elected. And they were called the Middle of the Road slate, and they were called Middle of the Road because they were both anti-communist and anti-blacklist. One of the people who was elected in that election was John Henry Falk, who was a radio personality. He became vice president of the union. Very soon after that, an organization called Aware Incorporated, and one of the directors of that organization was Vincent Hartnett, the man I mentioned earlier, the talent consultant, and they put out a newsletter in which they published seven instances of Communist Front associations with for John Henry Falk. A year and a half later, he was blacklisted. Unlike a lot of other people, he was willing to make an issue out of it, and he was able to get Louis Neiser, the celebrated attorney, to take on his case, and he sued Vincent Hartnett, Lawrence Johnson, and the organization Aware Incorporated for libel. And this eventually went to trial in 1962. This is something else which is different between the broadcast blacklist and the Hollywood blacklist. The Hollywood blacklist, it just kind of faded away over the years. There was no dramatic resolution. In the case of radio and television, was a very dramatic resolution. It was this libel trial involving John Henry Falk, which eventually took place in 1962. With the help of Neiser, he was able to win the case and was able to win a record-setting judgment of $3.5 million. And this really effectively ended the blacklist in broadcasting. It had started to fade in the previous few years, but this really definitively put it to an end.
Yeah. We have about, just real quickly, I mentioned for people who are listening, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is David Everett. He's authored a book about the blacklist in radio and television. His book is A Shadow of Red, published by Ivan D. If you'd like to read it, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think this is a really interesting case, the story of John Henry Falk, because he really, in a way more direct than a lot of other people, except that I can think of in broadcasting, except maybe Ed Murrow, took on the Red Hunters. And as you say, he actually sued them for the people who were associated with Red Channels, sued him for libel, won, secured this very large damage award. I don't think he collected anywhere near that, but as you say, that it was at the time the biggest libel judgment ever awarded in American history. Some people might remember him. His voice has been heard on public radio, in fact, within the last few decades. He passed away in 1990, so he's been gone for a while. Tell us just for people who had never heard his name or not really sure who John Henry Falk was, talk a little bit about him.
Well, he was a radio personality who was known as a professional Texan. He happened to come from Texas. And he had a show on WCBS, which is CBS's flagship radio station here in New York, in drive time. I think it was around 5 o'clock that it went on. And it was on his show, he was basically a raconteur. He would tell stories and do dialect stories having to do with characters he had known back in Texas. And he was reasonably successful in that role. And then came this incident with AFTRA, which suddenly, you know, catapulted him to public attention. And what's interesting about this is that it's all true that he was the one who brought this case to court, and it took you know, a great deal of courage and stamina for him to do this, and the outcome of the trial was certainly to the good because it did eliminate the blacklist. But what's interesting is that it might not have been necessary at all, because there was a point before when they were formulating the middle of the road slate for AFTRA, where everyone who was potentially on the slate was asked, you know, is there anything in your past that could be used by the blacklisters to embarrass or sabotage our efforts? And John Henry Falk said nothing. And he was someone who clearly should have spoken up. He had already been interviewed by the FBI and also by a House Un-American Activities Committee investigator. And he did have associations with groups like People's Songs, which were considered to be communist fronts. You know, whether, you know, he regarded that as a legitimate characterization or not is really immaterial here. The point is that it would be perceived that way. And it was really just a matter of time that he would be targeted. And you know, as a result, actually, he might have sabotaged the efforts of the middle-of-the-road slate to get things done and to get the blacklist practice out of the union by not speaking up about what happened to him. But ultimately, in the end, he was able to see this through. And he, you know, as I say, it was his case that brought the blacklist to an end.
Yeah. Why do you think it was that he was so willing to go to the mat here on this issue, or perhaps it was for him it was personal, and that it meant that as long as he was on the blacklist, he couldn't work.
Mm-hmm. You mean why did he go to the mat to sue them?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, he was, you know, it's interesting if you read his letters, which I did for this book, it's very obvious that this is someone who's very politically oriented and was very outraged by McCarthyism and by the blacklist. But he kept himself very quiet from, you know, 1950 until 1955. It seems he just didn't want to, you know, create any problems for himself. And I think this just made him very frustrated. And he was someone who was, as I say, was very politically oriented, and it was just difficult for him to keep quiet that long. And I think once he opened the gates and got involved politically in the after elections, it was just, you know, he couldn't keep himself from doing whatever was possible at that point. He was really determined after years of keeping silent to really follow this through to the end.
Hmm. And for, I just mentioned, by the way, that perhaps some folks who listen to public radio have heard John Henry Falk's Christmas Story, which he recorded back in the mid-70s for a long-gone program that used to be on NPR called Voices in the Wind. If you don't know anything about him, or you're curious, you'd like to hear his voice, you can hear that. It's on the NPR website, so you can go looking for that. And again, your questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit about this libel suit that Falk brought against Aware. This was in the spring of 1962, and that really was the end of the blacklist in broadcasting. I guess I was a little bit surprised that it went on as long as it did. That still in the early 1960s, that it was still going on at that point.
Yeah, it was, I think, kind of staggering at that point. And for instance, Lawrence Johnson was no longer involved in this sort of thing, and Vincent Hartnett was having a hard time maintaining his consultancy business, and there were things happening such as Jean Muir getting back on the air. She was the first cause celeb of the whole blacklist experience. So definitely certain people were able to chip away at the blacklist, but there still were definitely vestiges of it until 1962. And then if you look at the casting that was done almost immediately after his trial, you see people like Lee Grant and John Randolph and so forth immediately getting back on the air. John Henry Falk was able to get back on the air for a while himself.
Mm-hmm. What happened, though, that it ended, and it sounds as if, yeah, certainly it ended with a bang because of Falk and his libel case and his winning this big judgment. It sounded like it was losing strength, and chances are, would it have just withered, eventually would it have withered away?
I think it would have, in the same way that the Hollywood blacklist did, but what this trial accomplished is it really put a definitive end to it and really exposed the blacklisters in the public mind.
Hmm. Do you see, I suppose people will want to draw some parallels between, might want to draw parallels between that time and this time. Certainly there have been people who have been publicly criticized for being critical of the government and its policies. I'm not sure there's anybody has lost their job over that, but it's possible that someone could call in and say, well, yes, someone, because they were very outspoken and with a kind of a left-wing perspective, was actually fired from some job, or it cost them something. Do you see any kind of parallels between the way that dissenting speech would have been handled at this time and dissenting speech today?
Well, my short answer to that question when I'm asked that is no, because for the simple reason that there is not a blacklist in entertainment at this time. What you did see, though, for instance, is Danny Glover, who was fired from his job as the MCI spokesman on television soon after the Iraq War started. It was a campaign that was orchestrated by Joe Scarborough, a conservative talk show host on television, to get people to protest Danny Glover's appearance on these commercials. And that certainly replicates the kind of tactics that were used back in the early 1950s. But Glover was able to continue to work. You know, Bill Maher lost the show, because of things he said, but he got back on the air. And the really critical distinction is that there was no institutionalized blacklist. But I would also say, in other ways, it's still relevant. First of all, you know, in any time of emergencies, you know, we need to obviously be very careful and judicious about what sort of emergency measures are taken. I also think that what was going on then, which is still going on now, is this really fierce polarization of opinions, and that is still with us. And also, a very, I think, a fierce battle over who controls the political content in media, which is going on today. Recently, there was an attempt, for instance, to reinstitute the fairness doctrine in radio, which was clearly an attempt to limit the power of conservative talk radio. So I think you could see that this kind of attitude can exist on both sides of the political spectrum.
Mm. You talked back at the beginning about one of the things that sets the radio TV blacklist apart from the one that happened in Hollywood was that with the Hollywood case, that it was something that came from the top down. And in the case of broadcasting, it came from the bottom up, that it was very much a grassroots kind of thing, and that it was something that was driven by a very small number of people, basically the people that we've talked about, the three FBI agents who started the magazine, the newsletter Counterattack, and then produced Red Channels, and then also Lawrence Johnson, the Syracuse grocer, and Vincent Hartnett, the man who was the networks would go to get background on people to decide whether or not they wanted to hire that person. So here, a relatively small number of people actually made this go, although I'm sure that there were other people who were sympathetic to what they were doing. If not, they wouldn't have been able to do what they did. But still, you wonder about how it is that such a small group of people could have such a dramatic impact on what was in radio and television broadcasting, what was at that, certainly even at that time, very big industries.
Yeah, well, it's, I think, one of the most troubling aspects of it. And in thinking about it and thinking about why networks gave in so easily, and in the case of the networks, they had a weapon in their arsenal. They had electronic bully pulpit, you know, that they could have used to expose the blacklist practices, for instance, which they didn't choose to do. You know, in thinking about why they gave in so easily, really the only thing I can come up with is a stampede instinct. You know, once there was an alarm, they just panicked, and they didn't care who was going to be trampled underfoot.
What was it? You know, it's, I suppose some people would say it was kind of ironic that CBS, because it's been so criticized as being liberal, would have been the network that would have been the most eager to cooperate with these people. Was there? What was it about CBS, do you think, or was it, Canada, is there anything particularly that you can point to about CBS that made it so eager to or so cooperative when it came to trying to go after alleged communists?
Well, I think it really was the liberal reputation that it had. It made it feel as if it was especially vulnerable, and also because this was being, no matter what their politics were, this was being run as a business. And even William Paley, one of the most, you know, powerful corporate people in the country, said that, in effect, that he was powerless to do anything about it, which is, I think, a kind of a curious thing for him to say. But I think it was because, you know, combination of this liberal reputation that it had, which made it an immediate target, and just this willingness to do whatever was possible for short-term gains, and not looking at, you know, the bigger picture.
Real quick, we'll try to get in at least one call here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Have you considered the extension of the blacklist atmosphere into academia in the 50s? Here in Illinois, we had the Claiborne Act, which required us to, if you were going to be a state employee, whether it was at a university or anywhere else, you had to take a loyalty oath. In the early 50s, our high school history professor was hounded out of his job because of his apparently left-wing views. He was supposedly a communist, although I did never clipped into our classroom. And then I just remind you that just yesterday there was a news article about a Colorado professor, Ward Churchill, who was discharged because of, well, many things, but they quietly fired him after he was voicing unpopular views after September 11th.
Well, the Ward Churchill case I don't think fits, because there are serious academic issues with him as well. But as far as the blacklist in the 50s, as it extended into education, certainly that was something that was widespread. It's not within the scope of my book, but you know, what I'm writing about in the book is, I think, a reflection in a way of all the other areas where this became a factor in those days.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop, and again, for people who are interested in reading more about the blacklist in radio and television, you should look for the book that we've discussed. The title of the book is Shadow of Red. It's published by Ivan D., by our guest David Everett. And Mr. Everett, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.